working to lead and monitor this aggression. Of course, we have called on the United Nations to keep Ma'rib aside and in order to keep the people of Yemen safe. This is the main district in Yemen, which has very rich in resources, because Ma'rib also gives electricity to other sectors and districts in Yemen. But they transform this into a conflict, and the United Nations has called on marginalizing this area, but the enemy continued to launch its campaign, a military campaign against Sana'a and other areas. The Yemeni people had to launch a retaliation, an offensive against the posts in that area in order to liberate Baida and Jouf, and they have also liberated so many areas of certain small areas of municipalities in Ma'rib. You have around four districts or areas that were liberated within Ma'rib. This was the plan from the beginning, and they were liberated as planned. And now we want to liberate all of Ma'rib in order to bring it back to the nation, to its country, and to also liberate it from Daesh and Al-Qaeda. And we need, and of course, the military forces and the popular forces fight side by side the aggressive forces, and they know where the Al-Qaeda is, where Daesh is, and anyone who fights with Saudi Arabia and the mercenaries will be fought.
The Yemeni peace talks, of course, have been ongoing since 2018. What are the major sticking points, and have there been any headways so far?
في حقيقة الأمر فإن المفاوضات التي ترعاها الأمم المتحدة فيما يتعلق بالمسألة اليمنية.
In reality, the negotiations that are being mediated by the United Nations have more than one round of talks. We had two times in Geneva, and we also had two different talks in Kuwait and in Oman. We also have so many. We had some other talks in Sweden to talk about several files related to humanitarian issues and to talk about the issue of certain districts inside Yemen. But United Nations unfortunately moved aside from what is right when they did not translate issues in the right way. They considered the conflict a Yemeni-Yemeni conflict, but they should have said from the beginning that it is an aggression against Yemen. It's a foreign aggression against Yemen. In reality, we believe that the negotiations that are being mediated by the United Nations will only be a failure. That will be the final attempt of these talks, and this unless they are able to describe this aggression, this requires courage from the United Nations to speak about this aggression in the right way and not to say that they need to stop this aggression against the people and to say that this is an aggression from the Saudi Arabia and the Americans, and they need to lift the blockade against Yemen, and they need to withdraw all foreign forces, the Saudi, the Emirates, and others, and leave the Yemenis on their own in order to have their talks inside Yemen, as they also have, as this Yemen has been an aggression from the Saudis, is an internal interference. These talks, we've tried to say these words to the United Nations. We have not reached any solution in this. We've not reached anything. So therefore, unfortunately, the United Nations, they were not dealing with the issue
the
in a logical way.
And has really turned into a war of attrition and is costing Riyadh huge money and casualties. Does this mean that Riyadh has failed to achieve its goals in Yemen?
What is truth is that our main aims is to stop this aggression. There are the main aims for the aggression, and there are even hidden aims. All the aims that they have set in order to, they want to achieve in Yemen have failed very strongly, and specifically, there is no more a government for the president, Abdel Hadi Mansour, and they will not able to create any infliction upon the Yemeni forces and they wanted to break the will of the Yemeni people. But if we were talking about killing the Yemenis, about tens of thousands, or destroying the infrastructure of Yemen, they succeeded in that. There are also tens of thousands of wounded. Tens of thousands of homes were destroyed, and there were also losses on the central bank. There are also many people who are in famine, and there's so much hunger and famine in the country. This is what Saudi Arabia succeeded in very strongly. But anything else, they failed. A very heavy loss. They only wanted to enforce their hegemony, their political hegemony, on the Yemeni people. They could not enforce this hegemony. They could not change the government in Yemen. They could not even try to incite the people and stop the people from facing the Zionist project. So the war against Yemen was the ladder that Mohammed bin Salman wanted in order to reach rule in Saudi Arabia. The objectives of Saudi Arabia are the result of its lack of reality and its illegitimate endeavor. And they need to stop this aggression and lift the sanctions in order to give the Yemeni people their will. Then we need to stop also any interference in internal issues.
The Saudi-led coalition on the part of Riyadh and on the part of Yemen, Ansarullah movement. So these are on the outside, the warring sides. But the United States has been fanning the flames of the conflict. We do know that Washington has made a bundle out of selling arms to Riyadh during the conflict. Is there all about economic gains, or is there a political dimension to it?
The United States and its role on the aggression against Yemen, we said from the first day, is a Saudi-U.S. aggression. This began in the capital of the United States, in Washington, at the time of President Obama, and at that time with Adel al-Jubayr, when then he was the foreign, he was ambassador to America. And from the first day, from the first day of the aggression, the Saudi aggression against Yemen, they had support, logistics support, and intelligence support, and they had a big role to play in the support of the sanctions against Yemen, whether from the sea or the air or the land, and any sort of vetoes that were enforced on whether United Nations Security Council. Therefore, the role of the United States is the biggest and the aim, the most prominent role.
The Obama administration, it continued throughout the Trump administration, and now Joe Biden has promised, of course, to stop the U.S. aid to Riyadh and in the war against Yemen. Has anything changed so far?
Actually, the American president, Joe Biden, the new president, has also taken this file, the Yemen file, and the aggression as an election card, something that he can use to try to change. He said he wanted a direct ending of the war on Yemen. He wanted to launch political talks. But after he won the elections, he lied to his electors, and he was still continue to support the sanctions and the blockade, and he did not fulfill his promise in stopping this aggression. Of course, we do not rely on the promises of the U.S. because it was the time of the Democrats that launched this war against Yemen. So Joe Biden's promises will not be understood, and even the so-called Gulf Initiative, or the American Initiative, they will not enforce any sort of hegemony on Yemen. That was also even before that was signed by Joe Biden himself. But when they also failed ethically, the U.S. failed ethically, even through his electoral campaign that the United States will not fulfill the promise because it is the main partner in this aggression. They only wanted to try to mediate certain talks and to assist those who are Saudi Arabia and those who are launching this war against Yemen. And even there's the in, for example, the islands in Jayoun and Supatra, they are proof that the presence of the Americans there, and there shows that it is they are the ones.
Saudi Arabia has imposed sea and air blockade against Yemen that has kept the flow of food, medicine, and even humanitarian aid from reaching the desperate Yemeni people. I'm wondering how the Yemeni people can get their hands on the humanitarian supplies.
Also, dear brother, we cannot hide the fact that the sanctions is the other face of this aggression. There's one form of the aggression, which is the shelling and the bombing, but there is another form of this aggression, which is the sanctions, which has stopped the Yemeni and the medication and food from coming into Yemen and to the Yemenis. And here we're talking about thousands of people who are ill and need hospitalization. We're talking about people with chronic diseases, people who went to the Sana'a airport. We're not talking about one or two. We're talking about tens of thousands of wounded who could not leave the country in order to receive medicine and hospitalization outside the country. This has weakened the Yemeni people. This has shown the ugly face of the Americans and the Saudis who have enforced the sanctions against the Yemeni people. And people call on the international community to bring and allow the money to come in and the medicine and assistance to come into Yemen. Yemenis do not need assistance, but what they need is a lifting of these and sanctions, and we can bring in our own assistance, our own support. We do not want to call for assistance from any side, but what the international community needs to do is its duty to open the airports, to open the ports, and lift these sanctions. We do not need to call for assistance from them, but there's a catastrophe. There's a humanitarian catastrophe, and because it's closed, and this needs to stop, and allow the Yemeni people who also need this humanitarian, also need this humanitarian support. In this, what we've seen, of also that the humanitarian crisis, the United States, United Nations itself has said this is the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world.
People in Yemen are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from extreme levels of hunger. Tell us more about the humanitarian side effects of this Saudi-led coalition's aggression against your country and how grave the situation is for Yemen.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is very grave. We're talking about a humanitarian catastrophe which has resulted from this aggression. We cannot come and have numbers specifically now because these are adding up on a daily basis. We see that on the first day there was a certain number. On the second day, we saw that the number was double in the casualties and so on. The people who had, for example, main parts and so on, and wounded. This is a suffering of more than $10 billion of losses on the Yemeni people, but this will not stop the Yemeni people from confronting this aggression, stopping this aggression in order to retrieve the political will and political determination, freedom for our people. And the people, the free people of the world, need to stand with the injustice against the Yemeni people, who stand against this injustice against the Yemeni people. This is our campaign, and this is our national duty, and we see that we are with also the front of the resistance and Al-Quds and the resistance against Zionists.
All right, that's it for this edition of Face to Face. I'm Yusuf Jalali. See you next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Published in 2015, the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada estimated that 4,100 named and unnamed students died in Canada's residential schools. We now present you an article written by Erica Violet Lee, a member of Thunder Child First Nation. Erica Violet Lee is a poet, scholar, and community organizer. The piece is titled, Native Children Didn't Lose Their Lives at Residential Schools, Their Lives Were Stolen. We'd all heard the stories long before they started to receive this summer's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week coverage by every news station in Canada. Long before ground-penetrating radars confirmed the presence of unmarked graves, we knew that our missing family members did not simply disappear, nor attempt and fail to run away from residential schools, despite what we were told by missionaries and government officials. Indigenous communities are necessarily close-knit, and we live in the histories of our people, despite every effort at the eradication of our knowledge, culture, and languages, and of our lives. Published in 2015, the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, estimated that 4,100 named and unnamed students died in Canada's residential schools. To keep costs low, the report said many were probably buried in untended and unmarked graves at school cemeteries, rather than sending the students' bodies back to their home communities. Often parents were not notified at all, or the children were said to have died from sickness. An excuse commonly used to justify intentional genocide of indigenous nations, predicated on their supposed biological inferiority. My reserve community is Thunderchild First Nation, Saskatchewan, in the middle of the beautiful Northern Prairies. The institution intended for children from Thunderchild was called Saint-Henri, built in 1901 by the Roman Catholic Church. The creation of these residential schooling institutions was a direct result of Canadian policy aiming to remove Indigenous people from our lands and assimilate us into Canadian society. Neither the church nor the state is innocent in the continued genocide of our people. On 27th of May 2021, the graves of at least 215 Native children were officially uncovered at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School on Tekemloops, the Secwepemc First Nation, in the city of Kamloops in British Columbia. Less than a month later, 751 unmarked graves were located at Marival Indian Residential School on Cowessess First Nation in Saskatchewan. 6 days later, 182 unmarked graves were located at the site of St. Eugene's Mission School in Cranbrook in British Columbia. As the days pass, more communities are unearthing such tragedies. The outcome of this long-awaited reckoning involves multiple Native nations across the land delving into their own soils, pursuing the stories we've all heard from our elders and knowledge keepers. Many of us understand everyday Canadian schools themselves to be violent institutions of assimilation and colonization. In my predominantly Indigenous urban elementary school in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, I grew up singing "O Canada" and "God Save the Queen" at assemblies. In the lunchroom, Johnny Appleseed, a biblical song about a Christian God's benevolence, was to be recited before we were allowed to eat our school-provided meals. Still, the terms residential school and the U.S. equivalent boarding school are deeply inadequate. These residential schools, day schools, and boarding schools were actually prisons. These were forced labor camps. I recall hearing of Cree people, including small children, forced to work on sugar beet farms in brutal summer heat. This was a common practice from the 1940s to at least the 1980s. Farmers lured dispossessed and hungry Indigenous people into seasonal labor with false promises, then forced the workers to labor 12 to 14 hours per day with little or no pay. They slept in trucks, in tents, or empty grain bins. If they ventured into nearby towns, they were chased away with bats. If they tried to leave, their children might be taken away from them. Some of the stories we're told about residential schooling prisons involve Native children digging graves for other children. Rarely did our ancestors receive proper burials or grave markers. The soils of these lands have always known our hands as gardeners, as workers. These lands hold our bodies and the bodies of our ancestors. The soil that lies underneath so-called Canada has been hell, and it has been refuge. One thing is clear: Native children's lives are never lost. They're deliberately and violently stolen. Similarly, the lands of Indigenous people, from Canada to the United States and beyond, are never lost. They have been and continue to be forcibly colonized. The words we use matter for native life because these words define the past, the present, and the possible. Reckoning with the gentle language Canadians have been taught to use to describe the violence of empire is one part of the process of undoing colonization. In our communities, the accounting of Indigenous death feels relentless. We hear and see and feel the growing toll of graves uncovered, ever higher numbers recited seemingly hundreds of times daily on nearly every Canadian news network, endless repetitions of the phone numbers of residential schooling crisis lines to connect the grieving with mental health counsellors. None of this is enough. I refuse to play the numbers game. Our grief and our lives are not reducible to numbers or to statistics. As a Twitter user, Awahite, put it, Kamloops is not a unit of measurement. And to whose gaze are we appealing when we repeat these numbers over and over and over, hoping to evoke empathy from a settler state that cannot feel? Meanwhile, as Indigenous people, we are struck in the heart by those numbers every single time. There is simply no calculus that can account for the lives of each child stolen by colonialism's violence. All the moments of joy, curiosity, play, and learning that make childhood such a wondrous time, these things are immeasurable and immaterial. The lives experience of Indigenous childhood is irreducible to any European notion of property, and this is precisely why it is a threat to the colonial order. And what can the Catholic Church and the Canadian state do to repair the irreparable? The colonial institution of Canada will not reform itself, and it will certainly not end itself. Yet, there is one variable often left out of the calculation: our continued resistance. I think not only about the young ones who were stolen, but the childhoods that have been reclaimed by Indigenous resurgence and the all-encompassing love of our parents and communities. Indeed, our people are still stolen and killed. Indeed, our knowledge is suppressed, and our lands are colonized. In spite of this, what allows me to wake up in the morning and feel hope is all that we managed to save, all that which they could not take. Our languages and ceremonies were preserved and practiced undercover, hidden from the Indian agents patrolling our reserves, and parents camped in tipis outside those prisons, waiting to see their children. They never gave up, nor will we. The institution for children at my reserve, Thunder Child First Nation, in the middle of the beautiful northern prairies, was burnt down in 1948 by a fire set in the middle of the night. The fire was rumored to have been started by the children held in captivity at Saint-Henri. The institution was never rebuilt. Since time immemorial, many Indigenous peoples around the world have used fire to rejuvenate the land and restore order to the natural world. The lesson is that sometimes things must burn for the soil to heal and become healthy once more. As monuments and statues to colonial figures are toppled, and as Black and Indigenous communities continue to resist and heal, another world is becoming possible. In the next world that we are building on these lands our ancestors knew so well, no child will have their formative years violently stolen away by colonialism. They will be free, and we will be free.
The Spotlight. welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavit Ahway. Iraq's Ain al-Assad Air Base, hosting American forces, has come under a fresh rocket attack. This is the second such attack this week on the base in Iraq's western Anbar province. Ain al-Assad was also hit by 3 rockets on Monday. The latest attack came less than a day after drones hit another U.S. base at Erbil Airport in the northern Kurdistan. The U.S. is not welcomed in Iraq, and that is showing itself, with it coming under attack so frequently. So why is the U.S. so keen in staying in Iraq? Stay tuned to the Spotlight.
Iraq's Ain al-Assad Air Base hosting American forces has come under a fresh rocket attack. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said 2 personnel were injured after more than a dozen missiles targeted the facility. Less than a day earlier, a U.S. base at Erbil Airport in northern Kurdistan region was targeted as well. Security sources in Erbil said armed drones were used in the attack, which prompted the suspension of flights at the airport. These incidents are nothing new. Supply convoys for the U.S.-led military coalition in Iraq have come under repeated attacks over the past months. Anti-American sentiments have been on the rise since Washington's assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in January last year. Shortly after the killing of the 2 iconic anti-terror figures, the Iraqi parliament unanimously voted to end the American military presence. The legislation has fallen on deaf ears as the United States seems unwilling to leave the Arab country. On the ground, things look simple. The Iraqis do not want American troops on their soil. Why is it, then, one may ask, that the U.S. refuses to end its costly intervention there? The United States, that had invaded Iraq before, sent thousands of new troops there in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Baghdad declared victory over the terror group in 2017, but Washington has shown no sign of intending to leave the oil-rich nation. The U.S. cites the continued threat of Daesh as the reason for its long, drawn-out stay in Iraq, but what it's done over the past years put its stated purpose in question. Washington has regularly launched attacks on the positions of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, an umbrella organization which was the key in defeating Daesh. Such strikes have been strongly condemned by Iraqi political and military figures, as well as the public, who regard the U.S. military presence as the main source of tensions in the country.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. Also like to welcome Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from London, Ontario. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Becker, let me start with you and ask you a simple question. Why are U.S. troops in Iraq? Why does the U.S. insist to stay in Iraq?
Well, it's a very interesting question. You know, we have to take note that it was just several days ago last week that one of the architects of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, Donald Rumsfeld, died. Rumsfeld is a war criminal. At the time of the invasion, he was asked how long would the U.S. troops be there. This was in April or May of 2003, and he said, well, it might be 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months, but I guarantee you it won't be any longer than that. Well, now it's 219 months. It's more than 18 years, actually, that the U.S. has been in Iraq. And the occupation is one that is that grew out of the neocons' twisted vision of how they could remake the world, and that the invasion and occupation of Iraq would be a step toward a complete transformation of the region. You know, they even in the summer of 2003 came up with a new design for an Iraqi flag, I remember, that looked remarkably like the Israeli flag. It was blue and white and then had a little bit of yellow in it. But this whole idea, this illusion that they could change the whole world, and then once in the country, the occupation became bogged down. It became a quagmire. Despite what Rumsfeld said before Congress that I don't do quagmires, the U.S. almost lost the war and only was able to not have an a complete defeat by hiring a lot of the resistance who had been fighting against them, paying them off not to shoot at the U.S. troops. But this is part of, and remains a part of, a strategy of global domination. That is the fundamental strategy of the U.S. since World War II, and especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, that they could remake the world, and they could seize key countries and resources, and by doing so with 800 military bases around the world, sustain the domination. But you can see that it's really not working in Iraq, and that the demands grow louder for the U.S. to get out.
Exactly, and this past week has been just that, Edward Corrigan. And even the weeks before, where we're looking at attacks that have happened at Ain al Asad Air Base twice in a week, and we're looking at the drones that hit Erbil. Really an increase in attacks, but it's been slowly but surely increasing, not just this week, but over the past year, even longer, even though it's been sporadic. What do you make of the attacks that happened this week, where you're having them to have happened consecutively?
Well, it sends a message that the attacks were coordinated, and that there was at least three attacks that were launched at the same time against American targets, I guess two in Iraq and one in Syria. So there's a level of cooperation between the groups that are opposed to the American occupation forces in Syria and also the American occupation forces in Iraq. So that sends a message, just not random sporadic resistance from, you know, individuals. It's sort of, you know, loosely organized. I'm not saying it's highly, you know, centralized, but it shows that there's a degree of coordination. And of course, the Americans are the target because they're, you know, looting oil and other resources from Syria, and they've got no permission to be there from the Syrian government. There's no Security Council resolution authorizing their presence. Same thing in Iraq. The Iraqi parliament has asked them to leave by unanimous resolution. There's no Security Council resolution. What's interesting, the American position or justification for staying there keeps evolving. It keeps changing. The troops stay, but the excuse keeps changing. Initially, it was because, you know, Iraq was involved with the attack on 9/11, and then it had weapons of mass destruction. Both of those are lies. Then it became, to fight against, you know, the Islamic State, which also has been basically been eradicated, except for the support the Americans that are allies are giving it, moving them around. And of course, the people that are actually fighting the Islamic State, General Soleimani and General al-Mahdis, you know, they were assassinated in Iraq, and this is, you know, one of the top Iraqi generals killed by the Americans in his own country. And General Soleimani was there as the main, you know, person organizing the fight against the Islamic State, and he had been there at the invitation of the Iraqi government. This was a very flagrant violation, and also, in my view, a calculation to sort of raise tensions in the area and to have conflict, which, you know, the people pushing the buttons in Washington don't have to deal with. But of course, the soldiers on the ground in the desert and sweating in the heat, they're the ones that have the consequences of it. Another thing is that when there was attack on the base, people, they fired back, but just random. They didn't have a target. They just fired at civilian population as a sort of a knee-jerk reaction. And that actually is a war crime, because they were not targeting military people. They just were sending random shells into a civilian population, which did do some damage and injure some civilians. So that is a concern. It's not like they knew who was firing at them and then they retaliated in a pinpoint way. This was just general, you know, artillery shells fired at the Iraqi population, which is not going to make the Americans very favored in that area. And of course, it just antagonizes the Iraqi people more and, you know, puts pressure. But the Americans aren't listening to any sort of, oral requests. So the tension has been escalating now to attacks against the American soldiers. But as I said, this has been all evolving. You know, it's now, 18 years? Right. And, you know, they obviously are interested in the oil. And the other factor is, I don't think any president wants to say that we lost Iraq and we got kicked out and none of them want to have to leave with their tail between their legs. I think that's also part of the reason why the Americans have stayed so long in Afghanistan. But they have a won, but they don't want to be tagged with losing Afghanistan or losing Iraq or losing Syria, even though their positions there are, you know, are totally illegal.
Well, let's get one thing out of the way if we can with you, Richard Becker, and that is the assassination that took place of the Iranian, late Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, and also Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, which was a key architect for the PMU forces, which are considered part of the Iraqi military. We know that they were key and central in the fight against Daesh terrorists, of which they were able to eliminate them. So the question has come up, why would the U.S. assassinate these two figures? One camp says it's because the U.S. wants to have Daesh terrorists somewhat still there, so it could guide them, because there is this theory out there that, and many believe that it's actually true, that the U.S. does, in either directly or indirectly or covertly, support the Daesh terror group, or elements of these terrorist groups are supported by the U.S. Do you think that is the case, one of the reasons why these two were eliminated, assassinated?
Well, I think that the carrying out of the assassinations, which was a truly criminal act, as your other guest, Mr. Corrigan, indicated, and it brought the region really to the brink of a much wider war. And I think that the Trump administration, which when Trump and his generals having ordered this assassination, then had to pull back in what was clearly, the ANSA coalition that I'm part of called for demonstrations, and there were 90 demonstrations on just a couple of days' notice in the U.S. and showing that there was a great deal of anti-war sentiment inside the United States, a great deal of condemnation of what the United States did around the world. But this is a part of the ongoing war against Iran that's going on. It's not an all-out military conflict now, but the sanctions, which are an act of war against that country, the recurrent assassinations that are taking place, not only these that you mentioned that in January of 2020, but many assassinations that have taken place of scientists and other figures, and the attacks on shipping, on Iranian shipping. And so we can see that this is going on, is that there's, the U.S. is trying to, wanted to defeat, I believe, wanted to at least reduce very greatly the hold of ISIS, and particularly on a large part of Syrian and Iraqi territory. But continues to use different forces for what it sees as its advantage. I mean, this is cynical. That, you know, at the same time we have the U.S. government talking about lack of democratic rights, and that's why they're doing what they do to Iran with the sanctions in Cuba and Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, there's a very cynical power game that's going on, and different elements come into play in the U.S. strategy at different points in time and become more or less important. But that assassination, that was a part of the ongoing war against Iran.
Mm-hmm. Edward Corrigan, that is exactly one of the reasons that the Iraqi prime minister and Iraqi parliamentarians and Iraqis themselves, I'm sure, but the high-ranking Iraqi officials are saying, do not use our soil to settle your score or your differences with Iran, in a message to the U.S., especially not only last week when the U.S. attacked that same position on the Syria-Iraq border, where you had three of the PMU forces actually get killed, but the previous times, especially when Donald Trump said we want to use Iraq to spy on Iran. The U.S. clearly is not wanted by Iraq. They're definitely not wanted in Syria. Which comes back to my original question here, what is so important for the U.S. when it comes to Iraq? If we want to take a look at one reasoning that's been given, is that Iraq is used as a gateway into Syria. Do you think that that is the case?
Well, I think it is partially the case, because Iraq is centrally positioned, and it's a great forward staging area if you want to put pressure or attack Syria. Also to attack Iran, and it also, the Americans are concerned that the Shia in Iraq are, you know, forming close ties with Iran. So there's a joke saying who won the war in Iraq, and the answer is Iran. So they want to destabilize the area. They actually have a map of Iraq broken up into different areas, a Kurdish area, a Shia area, a Sunni area, and, you know, to break the states down so that they would still have, you know, sectarian conflict, but also be much weaker and easier to control. Former Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said that they wanted Daesh because it was a very useful tool, a weapon. And if you look at it, the Israelis, the Americans through the CIA and other groups were supporting, you know, Islamic State and bringing them arms and supplying them and to help them to destabilize the area. And if you look at the Islamic State, their attacks almost have all been against, you know, the Arabs and the Muslims in the area, and tried to provoke conflict. They were targeting the Alawites and the Druze in Syria. They were targeting, Shia positions and leaders. And the one thing they weren't doing, they weren't attacking Israel. There was a little bit of a problem where when Israel was taking out injured members of the Islamic State and treating them in Israel, a bunch of the Druze in Israel went and attacked them and killed them because Daesh was attacking the Druze in Syria. So that was a little interesting episode where the Israeli Druze struck out against Daesh, which is being, you know, helped by the Israelis. And because of their cousins and relatives that were in Syria that were being targeted by Daesh, because the Islamic State is sort of a Sunni fundamentalist movement, and they don't like the Shia, they don't like the Alawites, they don't like the Druze, they don't even like a lot of the Sunnis who don't take their extreme view. But a lot of this is fabricated, and it's, you know, somebody's fanning the flames to provoke these sectarian conflicts in the area. And this is an age-old strategy that the British use. It even goes back to the Roman times, you know, divide them up, have them fighting. And, you know, there's evidence that, you know, it was the British and the Americans that were going around causing some of these attacks. There was a celebrated incident where a couple British soldiers mm-hmm. were dressed up as Arabs and had weapons in the car and bombs, and they were stopped in Basra, arrested by the Iraqi authorities, which are aligned with the Americans. And the British sent tanks into the police chamber or the police prison to break these guys out. But why were they there? What was their purpose? Why did they have these weapons? Why were they in disguise? And why did the British just not ask them? Because this is, you know, their allies that had caught these British soldiers. And, you know, it looks as though, and the evidence, there's multiple examples that it was actually the British and the Americans and possibly right. the Israelis that were blowing these things up and trying to get conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, which would, of course, you know, would totally ravage and destroy Iraq even more than already had been done.
Well, you know, this is what's confusing here, and it really puts a question mark as to the U.S. purposes. Richard Becker, you did say, and you have said, that the U.S. Also is really sending messages to Iran in terms of what it is doing in Iraq with the attacks. I believe the stance that the U.S. has, obviously very anti-Iran. But the U.S. has also made announcements, like in April. It announced jointly after a strategic dialogue under Joe Biden with Iraq that they will withdraw their forces eventually out of the country. Did not provide a timeline, however. They also did pull out roughly about 2,300 to 2,500 troops out of the 5,400 that they had. So you still have a contingent that remains there. And you also had just recently where the U.S. announced the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and a couple of other countries that included THAAD missiles, so forth and so on. And this was in the Wall Street Journal, where it also cited that because the U.S. possibly is going to reach a deal with Iran, that it no longer will need these forces in the West Asia region. So what is the U.S. stance, really? Are they going to pull out, or is just they're trying to find the right time for it?
Well, eventually the continents will come back together, too. If we talk about, you know, eventual, what does that word even mean? The U.S. considers the region to be still of great importance, I would say in a certain way of diminishing importance from the point of view of the the U.S. global strategy. It's clear that the, and if you follow any of the military publications in the U.S., that they're preparing for war against China. There's a shift of forces. The pivot to Asia that started under Obama is intensifying. And the preparations for war are intensifying. So there is a desire on the part of the, of the U.S. I think that they will sign some kind of an agreement with Iran. We don't know what it will be, and I'm not really predicting that, but I think that they're looking in Washington and the Pentagon and in the national security apparatus is looking at ways to diminish its overreach in certain areas in order to overreach in another area, in other words, in Asia and against China. But the tactics that continue to go on of this divide and conquer, last year it was the 100th anniversary of the Great Arab Revolt, where there were uprisings in Syria and Lebanon, and particularly in Iraq and Egypt, in Palestine, when the people found out, the Arab people found out, and the Kurdish people too, that their territory was being redivided, and now not from the Ottoman Empire, but among the British and the French empires. And you know, at that time, and this is something to remember, is that the imams of the Sunni and Shia mosques went into each other's mosques in 1920 in Iraq and preached unity against British colonialism. So there's that tradition too, that the British and the U.S. and the French have, the colonizers have all practiced promotion of disunity at great cost to the people of the region, the people who were colonized by the and are okay. Neo-colonists okay. of the United States today.
Thank you very much. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Let me thank our guest, Richard Becker, who was talking there from the Answer Coalition. Edward Corrigan, thank you very much. International human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Do join us next time. From Mikhail Vitale and the entire team, it's goodbye.